This episode of Super Hungry the Podcast is brought to you by Hair by Kaylee Vandenberg. Based in Los Angeles, but available to travel anywhere, Kaylee does expert cuts, color, styling, and babification for women, men, and children. And don't just take my word for it, because she actually cuts mine and Steven's hair too. From concept to execution, this talented lady really does it all. And brides, are you looking for the perfect updo for your big day? Kaylee's got you covered. Her services include consultation, trials, and flawless day of execution. And if you've ever seen those really dope hairstyles on Instagram and Tumblr, yeah, Kaylee teaches you how to do those. She's got over 1.5 million views on her YouTube channel and has been featured on Lucky Magazine, Style Me Pretty, and Glamour.com. So check out her portfolio at KayleeVandenberg.com and book her to style you today. Hey, kids. Thanks for tuning in. It is Super Hungry, the podcast, conversations with not-so-starving artists, and I'm your host, Virginia Anzengruber. And this week sucked. I got laid off on Friday from my job. Like, I don't have a job anymore, which sucks. Oh, God. I got laid off on a Friday, and I'm recording this on a Sunday, so I'm basically still drunk from Friday. I had been having a lot of mixed feelings about my job anyway. I work in Santa Monica and live in Los Feliz. It's like 3 hours of my day every day. I love my job. I loved it. It was taking up a lot of my time. I felt like my life, my actual quality of life, was sort of dwindling. It doesn't mean it doesn't suck to get laid off. And everyone was really nice. They were really clear to make sure that I understood that it was a layoff and not a firing. And, you know, they were consolidating my position with an account controller or, you know, whatever. The guy that had to fire me, you know, the people that have to lay you off always never, you know, they're never the people that actually make the decisions or have any say in it. They're just the people that are stuck with the responsibility of making somebody's life shitty for a while. And that sucks that had to be this person. He was a pretty nice guy, and I thought I was coming in early for a meeting. Rather, I thought I was coming in early to cover for him for a meeting, and it turns out it was coming in early to get fired, laid off, whatever. They were great. I have, you know, 2 weeks severance, and I get my vacation payout because I was salaried, so I didn't take any vacation off yet because I really like my job. So I basically have a month's worth of pay on top of the 2 week paycheck that I just got on Friday. So that's like 3 2-week paychecks to figure my shit out. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm in this weird quarter life crisis mode that I kind of assumed would be like a nervous breakdown, just given my personality. Like, not that I was anticipating anything, but I just assumed of the crises, it would just be a breakdown. And I think what's really happening is that I actually just really enjoy this, performing. I like talking. I like storytelling. I like sitting in a microphone in a closet in Sherman Oaks once a week and telling you guys about what's happening in my life and talking to people that I admire about what's happening in their lives. And what is that? What is that to come upon something that you really like, maybe that you're even not terrible at, you know? I don't want to say I'm good at it yet, but maybe I'm not terrible at it yet. Maybe that's where I'm at. I'm not shitty at it. And I'm okay with that, because that means that I'm at least above the level of shit, you know? And I'm on the ladder or the scale or something, and I find myself giving a shit enough about it to put myself out here every week and sit in front of a microphone and tell you guys about my life and sit in front of this microphone and tell you guys that I got laid off on Friday and I don't know what I'm gonna do yet. And that's scary and exciting and scary, and I'll be fine. I'm, you know, that just means I'm freelancing again, but it also is, it's a reset, I think, for me to refocus on what I actually want to do. And if it's putting in the time to work my way up to producer, you know, production coordinator, production manager, producer, like, do I want to do that, or do I want to create? Do I want to be the creator? You know, I have a few sketches that Steven and I have written, and I'm directing my first music video with Matt soon, which, by the way, if you haven't heard, our Indiegogo campaign is live. We are looking to raise $600, so check it out on Indiegogo and the link on the post that I will no doubt put in the description. So I'm directing, I'm writing, you know, we've got these things in the pipeline. I have this show concept that I've created with my writing partner, Chad, and there are irons in the fire. You know, I said that last week, there are those irons. So it's just amazing what changes in a week. It's amazing what is impermanent in this business. I was weirdly like walking around anticipating this anyway, because I was coming from a situation of production and just very easily get laid off and that's it. And so part of me wonders if I even like put the secret out and then just like manifested this. But I'm grateful to have the time and the blessing of people who are going to help me find other work, but also to just this time to reevaluate and to take a step back. Because to be very honest with myself, this microphone, and you all, I've always known what I wanted to do. And that's not like trying to be cocky. Like, please don't listen to this and think that I, like, am sitting here with any sort of semblance of cocky. I have nothing. I have no cock. I'm cockless. But I've always known what I wanted to do. And it was always filmmaking. It was always this. It was always what I've been going towards. And then to sort of couple what you're talented at with your passion, right? So I'm pretty type A, I'm good at organizing, so it sort of made sense to just sort of step into that producer role, to step into that organizational role, and to facilitate, to be that person that facilitates. And that's fantastic. It really is. It's amazing to be a part of a project on every level and to sort of see it from inception to the end, to sit in a theater and hear people laugh at moments that you've helped create. It's one of the greatest joys that I've ever experienced and will ever experience. But what if it doesn't just have to be filmmaking? What if it is not necessarily being behind the camera? What if it is taking that leap of faith and putting myself out there every week and creating something that's totally mine? I sit in front of this microphone every week and I'm excited to share. And that is the crisis. I didn't realize that being the ham kid who was always performing for my family, or sort of like not always performing, but sort of joking and telling jokes and holding court and telling stories and talking with my hands like my dad. And what if that just means I just want to be in front of the camera and do something that way, or in front of the microphone and do something this way? It's scary and cool. And I got laid off this week, so I don't know what I'm doing yet, but I'm very excited to try something new. So I hope you're all having a great week. Write to me, respond, comment if you've ever been laid off and want to talk to me about it or whatever. Check out superhungrypodcast.tumblr.com, and we're also on iTunes and Podomatic, obviously. If you're a fan or a friend, please, please do us the favor of actually rating and subscribing on iTunes. And then if you felt like taking time to just write like a little comment, or, you know, just a little review with your rating, that actually really helps like the visibility of the podcast, so that I can kind of continue to gain followers and maybe make this new crazy venture something a lot of people can hear. So thank you so much to everyone who has followed and listened and commented and reached out. You're all incredible. If anyone is interested in advertising with the podcast, please do reach out to me, superhungrypodcast.tumblr.com. You can contact me there. I'm also on Facebook as well, Facebook Super Hungry the Podcast, so you can check that out. And I'm on Twitter, Virginia Anzengruber. I think it's at V Anzengruber, maybe, because my name's really long. But you guys can check me out. And yeah, reach out, comment, rate, subscribe. Let me know what you think. Shout out to our brother podcast, Old Geek Young Geek, hosted by my actual future brother-in-law, Scott Pell, who is a video game journalist and writer and player. And this year you may have actually seen him on the internet as Shenmue Guy. He teams up with his buddy and G4 alum Steven Johnson to talk about game culture, nerd culture, fan culture, and basically all things geek. So check him out on Podomatic and iTunes, and like him on Facebook. Old Geek Young Geek, for the geek of any age, I guess. Check out this conversation that I just had with my very enigmatic friend, Caleb Slane. He's a filmmaker and a writer. He's from Grand Rapids, Michigan, originally, and he does commercial directing. He's done a lot of narrative work. He was showing his first short film, one of his first short films, at Telluride when he was like 21 years old. So he's kind of one of those people in my life that's like a little bit prodigy status. He's very prolific to me. So I'm excited about this conversation we had. He's kind of always been like this enigma. So I'm like weirdly surprised I even sat him down for an hour and a half and got to talk about all of this. So check out this conversation I had with my friend, filmmaker Caleb Slane.
Thank you for coming all the way to Sherman Oaks on a rainy Sunday.
Yeah.
Did you wake up to rain at all?
No, I didn't. I stayed up to rain, though. I was working on my patio really, really late, or really early. Until like about 6, but it was really interesting because the rain started coming in. I didn't really believe it at first, and I do this thing because I don't want to go inside. I took like a towel and I kept typing, mm-hmm. you know, working, and I would just have a towel in one hand, so I was like just drying off the keyboard as I was working because I didn't really want to go inside. So
that's very like dangerous.
Danger
situation.
It's not dangerous. It's just you might ruin your computer. So eventually it got a little bit harder, and then I'd go in and then the rain would stop. So I'd go back out
and
then
I'd
come back in. And this happened like 6 times and I was getting really, like, I was mad. I think I was on the point of yelling, but I didn't wake anyone up.
That's such like an old man. Like, it's like a very Larry David.
It was just stupid.
It was like a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode. Just you against the rain.
I want to work. I'm on my patio. It's my patio. It's my patio. But it's frustrating because I just moved in there. So I didn't have anything, you know, you could put over or some sort of canopy or anything. I'm just trying to come up with anything that I can. I'm like using a coat on the broom handles and shit. Like, it was really embarrassing.
All of a sudden you become MacGyver trying to like just be able to work outside. Do you miss your patio furniture from your other place now?
No, I mean, it was a little bit nicer than what I have right now. It's a little bit more evolved. But it's kind of nice sort of being, I haven't really added much to it because it's so stripped down. It's sort of, there's something to that. You don't feel like you're settled into it.
Yeah.
You're just kind of, it's like, it's not yet your space. So I think there's something to having sort of a...
Do you like that?
Yeah, I do. Because I think that humans, me included, tend to be, you know, inherently lazy, and that's not
totally.
Like, that's not, I don't even say that as a bad thing, I just think you have a desire to get comfortable, and once you're comfortable, it's a very addictive drug, you know, maybe the most addictive drug.
Yeah.
So, I think that when you, it's just natural, so I think if you can keep yourself sort of in an uncomfortable environment as long as possible, and get comfortable in it, but not physically, you know, it's not everything that you need, it's not cozy, it's not perfect. I don't know, there's something about that just keeps it alive. It just feels sort of energized because it's
like that.
Yeah, sort of moving. Yeah, that's actually why this place has sort of been like flying a kite. Because like you said, I think that it doesn't take long for an apartment to become a sort of a coffin curated by IKEA and H&M.
Yeah.
Or whatever it happens to be. So like this was neat because I just gave my place to a couple friends and just took basically what I take traveling,
mm-hmm.
and plus maybe my desk,
yeah.
and one or two other things.
And you just left them your furniture?
Yeah, I mean, basically everything.
That's nice.
Everything. And most of my clothes, you know, I just took what I could fit into. Basically, I showed up there with a duffel bag and two.
I mean, do you have the freedom to go back and get more clothes if you need them?
If I need them, but I don't need them.
Yeah.
I have everything. And so it was an interesting experiment because, like you said, you kind of see these things and you don't really know what to get rid of or what to cut and so forth. And then you just kind of go off for a little while and you realize, oh wow, it's been a month and I haven't missed any of that at any point. But you're able to mm-hmm. do that safely, where I feel like in a few weeks from now we talk and I'll say like, burn the shit, like I don't care, because I'm like,
yeah.
it's not even a part of my reality
anymore. You
have anymore.
To separate yourself,
yeah,
from that,
yeah,
sometimes.
But kind of like trick yourself into it, you know,
yeah.
do it safely.
I get that. I do. I think there's cycles that people go through constantly where it's like you're shedding old ideals, old things, and I think to have a physical representation of that sometimes is so fucking cathartic, and sometimes it literally is just taking some boxes of stuff and getting rid of them, or taking your bag and leaving everything else. Like, that's kind of, that's that physical manifestation of, all right, cool, It's like a new... I like that. I think that's a really cool thing. Mm-hmm. I think I have a lot of DVDs and books, so I haven't quite mastered it yet. But that's cool. Are you liking the new space, other than the fact that it's kind of sparse? Or that's what you like about it, I guess?
Oh, yeah. It's great. You know, when I first moved to L.A., it was... I came here for a film festival. I'm sorry, not when I moved, when I first visited. Mm-hmm. And it was downtown. It was at the...
what festival was it?
Downtown Independent. It was actually the Red Festival.
Cool. When was that?
Which sort of just came back at me in a really interesting way, that experience, the other day. Pardon? You said the Red Festival?
I said, what year was it?
Oh, that would have been the end of 2012.
Okay.
Like December or November, something like that.
And they just contacted you again?
No, actually I ran into the guy who used to work for Red, and he's now working for, Fox, running their, VR and experimentation department.
Very cool.
Which is, we met at the Oculus Connect conference.
That's right.
So that was kind of neat. But, when I first came to LA, I fell in love with downtown. That was mm-hmm. what I liked.
Yeah. You know,
I thought it was really neat how it was this major metropolitan area in, one of the biggest cities on our continent, and completely like derelict in so many ways. I just thought that was fascinating. This sort of
juxtaposition. It's the biggest really nice city. Yeah.
It's not like the most populated. New York's the most populated, but LA is the biggest city mm-hmm. in this country, in the wealthiest country in the world. So the biggest city in the wealthiest country of the world, the heart of the metropolitan area, is like derelict and is actually the capital, the headquarters of figuratively of homelessness in this country.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's just, I mean, it's interesting. I'm sure there are books that exist on it, but it's just really, really bizarre. You know, I think all contradictions perhaps in this country exist in that neighborhood.
There's a lot of energy. I always find it interesting how it immediately is like lifeless at night. Like, cause you would almost expect that there would be, cause there are some restaurants and there are some bars, so you would expect that there'd be something, mm-hmm. but it's like, as soon as it's not business hours, it is like, quiet. Mm-hmm. It's quiet down there, which is kind of scary to me.
Well, it turns into something else, you know?
It's, yeah.
On the weekends, it's a little bit different now.
Yeah, because, like, bookstores and stuff are down there.
Even 3 years ago, it was much emptier.
Yeah.
When I would be down there, when I first came here, than it is now. So, I came here, and I saw downtown. I thought that was really interesting, and I moved, and I ended up finding this really neat place right outside of downtown, mm-hmm. up on Mount Washington, and that's been a really fun journey, no regrets. But yeah, I was just decided I wanted to go spend some time down there like I originally planned.
Yeah. So you moved here from, where are you from?
I moved here from Grand Rapids, which is a city in Michigan.
And that's where you were born?
That was where I was born, yeah.
How many people in your family?
I have, in my immediate family members are... two parents mm-hmm. and 8 siblings.
Are your parents still together?
Yes.
How long have they been married?
They've been married for, I have no idea, maybe 30 years.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I keep meeting people whose parents have, like, been together for so long, and I kind of love that because my parents were actually never married. So to have parents that were, like, because my parents were, like, together for the time it took to make us, basically. Mm-hmm. But my dad is obviously still super involved, but I keep meeting people whose, like, parents have, like, really been together, and I just find it so interesting. Do you feel like it affected your childhood in a positive way to see, like, a good representation of that, or was it, you know, a little chaotic?
I have no idea. I don't really have any perspective on it, to be honest. I mean, I know people who have, you know, completely crazy childhoods and are great, and some who have... what appear to be ideal childhoods and are not. So I don't know what the rule is to it. I guess that the only thing that really mattered was that my parents were honest with me growing up.
That's cool.
To the best of their abilities. Now, I grew up and then realized I disagreed with them on many things that they told me.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that they weren't being honest about it when they said it.
What do they do?
My dad does, he does a range of things right now. He was a fire sprinkler. He did fire sprinkler installation.
Cool.
And then he ran his own heating and cooling business for years. I used to, like, help him when I was a kid.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's like I'd go and make, you know, scraps of money, working out with him in these job sites, when I was, like, 7, 8, 9. And then my mom's been a stay-at-home mom, you know.
Cool. cool.
Raising and homeschooling, or unschooling, technically.
Were you unschooled?
I was unschooled.
Yeah. That's cool. Did you ever get a GED or anything like that? Or?
No, I knew that that was a... I kind of knew that that was a... I don't know where it came from. No one really ever taught me. I just had this feeling like it was all a joke. So I just told people that I did so that they wouldn't, like, bother me about it.
Yeah.
But, no, I didn't. Like, when I left... I went to a public school the last 2 years.
Yeah.
So I went to one called Kenowa High, and then I transferred to another one. Both out of the... I mean, I grew up downtown, kind of a rough area, so... going to school down there didn't really present a lot of opportunities. But thankfully I was able to get into like using a school of choice program, as we call it in the States, get into a couple of schools that were a little bit better off. So then my senior year, I went to a place called Rockford, which is a wealthier school district. When I was there, I just kind of told them, hey, listen, I don't need a diploma. I'm going to get a homeschool diploma, which wasn't exactly true. I mean, it was true at the time, but it didn't end up being true. But they were like, okay, they got it. So I just spent my senior year basically doing whatever I wanted. You know, all classes were electives. So I did like choir and psychology and sociology and internships and teacher's assistants and whatever weird, you know, they called me the interesting situation.
But, like the air quotes.
Yeah. I didn't have to take, the SATs or the ATTs or the AT&Ts or whatever the fuck they call them. ACTs.
I'm looking at you so bitterly because I had to take them twice.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing was, I also didn't sit through a graduation. That was the most important part. when I left, at the time that I told them that, I think I had a feeling that I was going to do film. And I think that that was right about the time when I was about turning 17, I had this feeling like I was going to direct films. I'd been making films since I was pretty young, but it was like this weird feeling like that's what I'm just going to do.
Yeah.
So I started kind of dedicating that year to preparing to do that role, and part of that was planning to go to film school.
Mm-hmm.
And that appeared to me that if you had decent films that you'd already made, no one would care what your grades were or what your
diploma
was, or it didn't matter. You know, if I could walk into a film school and have a meeting and just show them, I'd already done it. Like when I was, I think when I turned, before I turned 17, or somewhere around there, I took my first trip to New York. It was my first time being, I mean, I'd gone to Chicago many times growing up. It's only Grand Rapids is two and a half hours away
from
Chicago. But I went to the to New York. I actually drove. My dad was working on a job site there, right outside of the city in Pennsylvania. And it was late one night, and I was gaming. I used to play Halo a lot. And my dad came, and he said, "Listen, I'm really, really tired, but I have to get to this job in Pennsylvania. Could you drive me?" Now it's like 10 at night or like 11 at night. But this seems like a really cool opportunity, so I say, yes, of course. So, 10-hour drive, you know, through the night. My dad is sleeping. You know? I've been up for so long. I remember this feeling where I'm like, where I'm just trying to keep my eyes open, and it's the middle of a thunderstorm, and there's this one moment, so vivid, 3-lane highway, and there was a semi on one side, and I was trying to go fast because I know he had to get there too, so... It's middle of the night, semi on one side, semi on the left lane, right and left. And I go down the center between them. And it's like heavy rain, like can't see rain. And the highway starts to bend and turn. And I remember this feeling of like watching these two semis on both sides of me start like arcing around.
Yeah.
And I'm in this little, you know, shiny orange Grand Prix. You know, it looks like a toy, a Christmas toy. So it was an experience. So I got to New York and, my dad brought me down.
Oh my God, I thought you were going to die or something.
No, that was, I mean, no, but it was like, it was just, you know, I think that when you're going into a new environment or something and there are some dramatic circumstances in which you arrive into that environment, it just kind of like...
Makes it feel like its own...
It colors in the story. You know, you feel like you're on your way. It's kind of an indicator. Hey, there
you're like, this is a trip.
Yeah,
like,
there are interesting things to come. Yeah, it kind of, you know, calibrates your mind to be expecting exciting things or maybe I don't know. But he brought me into New York when we arrived there, and then he said, listen, I have to go to, it was really, really, really early, but he's like, I have to go to the job site, and I said, well, could you just leave me here? So my first experience in New York City, it was my dad dropped me off at the bottom of Manhattan, And I spent the entire day just walking around, and I had three different outfits on. So in the morning I had like this hoodie and was like really low key, and I just like walked with all these people who were going to work, and it was just like completely silent and just feeling like what the pulse of the environment. And then after a while, when I was walking, I'd known about the New York Film Academy, so I ended up going there. And then kind of told them that I was from a film school, which wasn't true. I was from a high school. But it told them that I was there to, like, from my film school in Michigan to get some information. I wanted to just, like, record a couple things around there. Anyway, after a bit of talking and them kind of scrutinizing, they finally let me in.
Nice.
So then I spent, like, the day just roaming around these classes, ended up in this acting class, and told them I'm from another film school, and it's all actors, and they're performing this scene. So then suddenly the teacher was like asking me for, they were like shooting like a test scene,
yeah.
And he was like asking me for some input on like the lighting and how they should be shooting it, and it was like, it was really great. But I think it kind of reaffirmed that feeling of like, you know, you can walk into anything, and if you have a good enough reason to at least say that you're there, you can probably go a long way. So I had this idea that I didn't really need a
high school. Most bank robbers.
I didn't really need a high school diploma. Yeah, so I didn't do that. I just spent the high school year just kind of learning, doing plays, writing, doing short films, and then went to film school.
Where did you go to film school? I know, but for the listening.
Oh, well, I went to Compass Film Academy, or maybe they call it Compass Film College, or maybe they call it Compass Camera Studio, or maybe they call it Compass...
sponsored by Coda.
Universities.
Yeah.
Sponsored by Grand Rapids. So I went there for a few months, and I had... I didn't have a lot of money at the time, and me nor my family, nothing. So I had to get like a co-signer on my loan. And then once I started the school, they dropped out. So then I couldn't figure out. I tried to work with them,
mm-hmm.
sort out how I would be able to stay there in the film school. Because I'd begun developing a community there. It's a 24
yeah.
person program, you know, it's kind of a mentorship program.
You make friends really well.
Yeah,
really
I mean,
tight.
Your fiance,
yeah,
I still see and work with, and
I
he
know.
Was a
That's
part of those
how we met.
24 people. So,
yeah.
Even, you know, if that indicates how
close knit you guys
yeah,
stay.
Yeah,
yeah,
it was really intimate. So a few months I was working with one of their instructors to try to find a way to raise money so I could stay there, whatever. I was doing really
mm-hmm.
well. They wanted me there. All things were good except for just money.
Yeah.
Then the guy that I was working with, we all went to Thanksgiving, and his name is Dave Phelps. And
good guy, Dave Phelps.
He is a good guy. So Dave is like the one of the two people that really got me into that school and excited about it. And his class was really great and really opened up my eyes to he taught an artistic philosophy class,
mm-hmm.
And that left a large impression on me. So we all, and all the people there, you know, first time we were hearing some of these ideas, these concepts about beauty or meaning or purpose or work or, you know, depth of what we're doing.
Right.
Which I think sometimes gets glossed over a little bit in other art programs, you know. There's like, there's
all
a,
about the technicality.
But there's no, I don't know, there's a value of like just channeling yourself and expressing yourself. But I also think that there's like something interesting about taking responsibility for your work as like the power that it can have.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, we left for Thanksgiving break, we came back, and he was gone. There had been this whole rift at the school, which was a complete, what's the word they say? Scandal. Yeah, scandal.
Which,
so,
I remember hearing about it. I didn't go there, so I wasn't, like, in on any of the gossip, but I do know that that happened.
Yeah.
So, what did that change for you when you came back?
Well, he was the person I was working with, so, and it seemed to me that there wouldn't really be much of a way to put together X many tens of thousands of dollars
right.
that I had absolutely no access to. So the end of that 3 months, 3.5 months, whatever it was, the first of 3 semesters, because they do a summer semester, they call it. I dropped out, but I kept like one, they let me keep one class. Normally they don't do that, you know,
mm-hmm.
but because I was there, I was like, hey, can I just keep paying for this one small thing? But it was really strange because I was working at the YMCA and I was 18 and I was working there a lot to sort of continue paying for this debt that I'd already accrued with them.
Right.
Which, sure, I could just disappear or whatever, but I'm there to stay. You know, I'm here to do it. So I'm not gonna, you know, I'm expecting to see these people in the future.
Right.
So, but I was interning at the school, and that was what was really interesting, is that I was interning at the school to help kind of pay down this debt while I was going there. And then when I stopped going there, it's like, I'm still interning there.
To pay off the debt.
So suddenly, it's like, not only am I just like, hey, you can't go here anymore, and it's like, I'm still there, mm-hmm. but now I'm working behind a desk, watching all my friends go into the class.
Oh, that sucks.
It's just really interesting. And I'm not like an emotional or like sentimental person with that sort of stuff, so it didn't really affect me in that way. Mm-hmm. It was just, but I realized it intellectually at a certain point, like,
yeah,
this is really bizarre.
Yeah,
you know, this is really bizarre that you're finding a way to be okay with this.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, I mean, it was really hard at the time. It was very hard.
Well, absolutely.
But that's... it ended up being, you know, ultimately it was there is something, we're talking about discomfort, you know.
Yeah,
it ended up being, I think, one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I think the discomfort in that situation created a lot of friction that just, you know, forced me to move into these, you know, really bizarre situations. I don't know. I just got busy with, like, local filmmakers and local production companies and just started writing. And mm-hmm. it was like, you know, no one else is going to help me do this but me.
Yeah. So you just put yourself out there.
Yeah. So that, yeah, by the end of the year, I'd already done, like, 3 different films and was mounting a major production as they were, you know, just getting out of school.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not solely responsible. There were a number of incredible people who made those things possible and, you know, worked as hard, if not harder, than I probably did. But yeah, I think that it kind of set the stage for, like, I don't really get upset when things go really wrong.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be this big turn, I feel, always, inevitably, down the road where you, at some point, you're really happy it happened the way that it did. I think there's only maybe 1 or 2 things I can think of that pushed the truth of that. You know, I think there are only a couple of situations, I was thinking through them, that might not have, like, right. Sometimes I wonder, I'm like, was that worth going through? Did that have, like, a good result? You know, but I guess you need those two.
I hope that's how I'll feel about the getting laid off.
Well, yeah, just, like, and that's your choice. That's what I believe is. I think that, you know, you constantly have a choice to do things on your terms or someone else's.
Yeah.
And I think that there are these things that happen where things happen on another person's terms. You are laid off. I am kicked out of film school. Someone else is, you know, divorced. There's a window of opportunity where I think that you have a choice of whether or not it's going to be on your terms.
Or if it's going to make you crumble or rise.
That's it. You know, but if you say, well, is it going to make me crumble or rise? Well, what does that mean? What does that look like? Are you waiting for another thing to show up? Again, it's sort of allowing this sort of force outside of you to dictate, you know, what is going to happen to you. And mm-hmm. that's just like saying that I'm going to do this my way.
Yeah.
And you have a chance to do that. I think that people are tragically afraid of how powerful they can be. I think it's the scariest thing. There's nothing like, it takes incredible bravery to be able to face the actual potency that you can have on your environment, on the people around
you.
Yeah,
it's terrifying.
It's very terrifying.
I mean, because really, when you delineate what that statement is, it's like, it's believing that you're valuable enough to go out on a limb and say, this thing that I love so much, I'm going to go at it. Whatever it is, it doesn't necessarily even have to be a thing that's, like, making you money. But whatever that thing is, to go after your passions wholeheartedly and not care about the consequences, that's a terrifying concept, mm-hmm. just objectively.
Or just, like, it's just easier, I think, to be a victim to something or to be coping with something. Or to be
comfortable in insurance. And do you know what I mean? It's, like, it's comfort in the ability to take care of yourself, because I feel like it's different. Being an artist in 2015 in America right now is a different thing than it used to be 20 years ago in America, 30 years on art.
It's difficult because I think with just the internet and the sort of democratization of information and access to equipment and to tools. And I think that it's difficult to, there's a, you know, it's really murky. It's difficult to discern. Like, everyone's an artist. I think that's a great thing. Everyone has a chance to, you know, create something, you know, or maybe I wouldn't say everyone's an artist, but I mean, I think every person has an inherent creative spirit to them,
right,
that in our current landscape they're able to exercise in interesting ways, whether that's photography or whether that's recording some YouTube video of covering a song or whatever the hell it is. But I think that it just makes it a little bit difficult, because it's not like, hey, there are all these people over here who are laborers, and there's these couple delicate souls here who want to make sculptures, and like, oh, aren't those sculptures nice, we should help them so they can keep making them and make our, you know, our landscaping look
impeccable. Do you think that makes it harder to be able to survive as an artist, as like a working artist, because of the democratization? Do you think that makes it harder to find the jobs that are paying valuable to you?
I don't know. I wasn't working in before that. So this is all I know. Yeah. So it's really hard to say. You know, maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
I think there's something about old Hollywood that's interesting, where it's like, you know, but people used to complain back then, all, you know, you can't do a film unless you have all this money. So it's controlled by studios, and then you have to do it their way. So, and now we're like, well, we have all this equipment and we can do it for low cost, but we still can't, but no one wants to fund those because those aren't like, you know, marketable or whatever. It's always something going wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that, and that's where I think that the sort of the true forces of the time are able to break through whatever problems there are. And that goes back to what we were even saying, where it's like, you get given something that's not great, something happens to you, and it is so motivational speaker bullshit
about
like, turning, like, I'm going to take this bad thing and turn it into an opportunity, you know? And I think that that's like, that's kind of hard to wrap your head around sometimes, I think, or rather to just do that. But I think that when you're, I think if you let go of any type of entitlement and any type of sense of like, this
you're
is,
owed something,
or any type of sense of like what your life should look like or what you want it to look like, and you sort of really operate move by move, turn by turn, like you're playing a chess game, and just don't get too far ahead, you know, just make your next move. You can get upset about it, right? So I think that when something happens, it's like you have this chance to, you get laid off. It's like, great. I have a month that I can work on something I've been wanting to be working on.
I know. You know? It's actually kind of nice.
It's not, but it's so easy to say, to use that as justification to, like, take it easy, you know? Or, like, fuck, I got laid off. Like, I can't even, I don't want to deal with anything right now. I don't want to be upset. And I'm not saying that people aren't supposed to have emotions about things.
But to make it paralyze you is different than
I think emotions are a reaction of the way that you see, you know, reality. That's where your emotions come from, your perception of something. It's like a child looks at a situation and they see two people talking. It's not going to make them sad if they don't realize what they're talking about.
I think emotions can be a little bit visceral too, though, because I think that in that moment for me, there was the immediate visceral reaction, not my perception of the situation, but the actuality, the visceral band-aid removal of like being escorted out of the building and having my having to turn in my badge. Do you know what I mean? There are those moments that are the actual shot in your arm.
Sure enough.
You know, and so that is a
why? Yeah, because it is, that is your, that is the reality that you're literally in. You are literally handing over the badge.
Yeah.
You're literally walking out of the building.
Like
it's a little bit difficult to be operating in some cloud.
And then when you drive, you know, the drive home was the perception. That was, because the drive home is the, I wonder, you know, and then all of the, and then honestly, it was kind of very, Stella got her groove back, but I like, because it's LA, it took me a fucking hour to get home, you know? And by the time I got home, I had cried and cried and cried and cried and I hugged Steven and cried some more and, you know, and then I was all right. Like, I wasn't amazing and I went and got drunk and was been kind of drunk all weekend and that's okay. And, you know, had drinks this morning with breakfast and, you know, like, but that's okay. And it's that being okay with the reality that I'm in.
Well, I think it's
doing laundry.
Yeah, it's just
deciding the perspective and how I'm going to react to it.
Yeah, you know? Deciding what you want this to be, this period to be.
Yeah.
Now, maybe you don't have an answer immediately, but then again, it goes back to the moves, you know? Just, yeah. Well, what's the move today going to be?
And you know what? Today it was mimosas with brunch and then recording this podcast, you know? But that was okay, you know? And Friday night it was getting drinks at Tiki Tea and, like, chilling, you know? Like, and that, there was a different calm that came from that that mm-hmm. just makes me feel like it's okay. And that is nice. It's this other flip side of this, like, quarter life crisis, which is, like, letting myself just, like, be a human mm-hmm. being, kind of, which is a hard thing to do. I mean, and you're one of the hardest working people I know, so I wonder if sometimes if that's something you deal with. As someone who works as much as you do and travels as much as you do and sort of, like, I don't want you to think that I am puffing you up to use the word prolific, but as someone that I know that is prolific, you are, for me, you are consistently creating singular narratives that are very clearly in your voice but have their own voice. And for me, that word always comes to mind when I think of you, because you're consistently working, you're consistently creating, and you have this ability to...
That's interesting. That's the perception, because I don't feel that way at all.
And that was my question, is that what is sort of your perception on that? Because for me,
I feel like
when
I'm like one of the least prolific people that
see,
I know.
When I look at you and I look at the body of work that you've created, that is so, it so clearly is your voice, you know? And it's interesting because narrative and commercial stuff with both. Like when I look at your website, because obviously I was like researching you earlier today. I always feel creepy when I tell people that I was like
researching. Did the website work for you?
Yeah. Oh God, it's great.
Did you use the scrolling function?
I did both. Okay. I clicked and did the scroll.
We're working on we're going to do a 2.0 soon. That was just the first one. It was pretty, you know,
I like it.
Unusual, but the one thing was like,
it wasn't as hard on mobile and stuff.
Well, we didn't really refine it for mobile ultimately. I didn't really have the budget to do it at the time. But like the whole scrolling thing is that, you know, that's kind of how it's supposed to work, but not everyone does that. They kind of sometimes use the bottom. But anyway,
I scrolled and then I liked to click when I wanted to go back to your bio right away.
Well, yeah, that's why it's there. Yeah. That's why it's there. But I think that, yeah, we have a way that it might be arranged better. Anyway, interesting.
No, that's sort of, I mean, that's my perspective on you, because obviously I think everyone in their own mind is their own harshest critic. You know, I'm always like, God, I could be fucking doing way more, and why am I not, you know, we have these sketches we've written, like, why haven't we filmed them, you know, mm-hmm. just all of that in my mind. As someone who, for me, my perspective on you is that of being prolific. What is your perspective on yourself right now? Like, what, with all the work that you've done, all the traveling you've done this year, last year, the year before that, and all the time that I've known you, like, how do you see yourself?
Well, I don't know. I try not to see myself as anything, which is maybe a part of sort of being in a 25-year-long existential crisis.
You just came out of the womb going, what is this?
Yeah, just learn to say that, like, louder and louder. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I'm working on right now, it's difficult because I can't really talk about it, and it can't... I can't really share it. So it's a certain amount of sometimes where there's like a limited, it's the illusion that you're not doing anything because you're not really recognized for a lot of the stuff
right.
that you've done, you know?
Do you think that illusion is from yourself though? Cause I don't have that illusion of you of not doing anything.
No, I mean, I just think that you look at sort of the timeline and you realize like, oh, you know, there are these huge gaps of like, there's nothing really going on or nothing really, even
right.
though I'm doing these things, completing things, like whatever.
Yeah.
But I can't, you know, they're private
the
or they're works
the
in progress
project.
Or they're whatever. And, you know, and for me, I just spent like a really long time developing stuff, and whether it's a script, whether it's something in post, and, you know, I don't mind taking the time that it needs to do it right. And sometimes it does take a while. Specifically the project that I'm working on right now, which is in virtual reality. And we just keep running into obstacles. I've spent the last 7 months maybe working on a script
mm-hmm.
that was originally written for film and then adapted to be in the virtual reality space and slowly kind of transformed into this kind of this larger project.
Mm-hmm.
But working in an arena where the technology is sort of, you know,
behind a little bit.
Yeah. You're building the plane as you're, you know, in the air, right?
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah, no, but that's what it feels like, though, because you're all sort of in this thing, but you're kind of you're just waiting to collect a new piece that is missing, a new piece of technology that shows up and is going to solve some problem that you're dealing with there. Live action VR is very tricky in general. What we're doing is really experimental and unusual for mm-hmm. how that space is being used. So, anyway, but that process has been just long and.
Yeah.
Exciting, but it's like, yeah, it takes a while to get that stuff to come around if you're going to do it right. It's like trying to understand what a country is like without actually being there.
Yeah.
There's just something that you can't get until you go put your feet on the ground mm-hmm. and walk around the streets and spend a day having conversations with people. That's kind of what VR is like, unless you've really used it. And most people who even have used it have used really... I would say embarrassing versions of it. It's just not a good example of like what its potential is. Once you use it in something that really is pretty well done, despite the current limitations, it's eye opening. It kind of is like amphetamines for the imagination. Your mind just starts spinning into, you're like, oh my God, I can see how this could be this, and this could be this, and this could be this. And
just like a kid in a candy store, kind of.
Yeah, the implications are just incredible. I think that in 5 to 10 years, I think VR will have as great, maybe 10 years tops, as great of implications on the world as the internet.
Wow. Okay. I'll check back with you in 10 years.
And I think that people make the mistake of thinking about it as an entertainment platform or gaming platform. That's just the beginning. That's where they'll get grounded and they'll make money, but it's going to build on the shoulders of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But what it really is for humanity, for the psychological, emotional, spiritual capacities of human beings and what that will be able to open up. Is absolutely tremendous.
Cool. It must be weird to be so close to having something done that you feel like would affect.
Oh, it's not close to being done.
You're like, we're not even close.
We did some extensive camera tests to help raise some money for the project, and so we just kind of finished that recently with working with this great team in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So
you grew up in Michigan, you kind of did high school, you kind of did film school. What was the thing that got you out of Michigan? Because I know you did something before you left Michigan, and that was a short film, correct, called Free Pie? Was that the thing that sort of got you out? Or
no, I mean, I don't know if that film's the thing that got me out. I think that there were numerous experiences leading up to that, from just traveling and going, bringing a couple of pieces, mainly the short doc that I did, It Ain't Over, and then also the Lost and Found Shop, bringing them around the country to different film festivals, and mm-hmm. going to South by Southwest, and then going to Telluride, and going to Nifty, which I've been going to for a long time.
What year did you show at South by? Because I went in 2010, and just as a, you know...
Yeah, so you asked me how did I get out? How did I get out of Michigan?
Yeah.
And when I was growing up there, I didn't really have the money to travel. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even go past, you know, Illinois until
right.
I was 21, I think, or shortly before, something like that. And I didn't leave the country until I was 22. And I literally the first time I left the United States, hadn't even gone to Canada, because it's like, why? I just never had a good reason to go there. But was to direct a global commercial, which started in India, and then went to Japan, and then went to Shanghai.
What company was the commercial for?
It was with my old reps, Workhouse Creative in Seattle. And I was doing a spot for Microsoft.
Cool.
So I had done the first Surface commercial with Keith Rivers, who owns Workhouse, and we met at a film festival there. And then he asked me to come and spent like a month in Seattle working on it, and that was really successful.
Yeah, you guys got a couple like millions and millions of views, right?
Yeah,
on YouTube
yeah.
now.
I don't know what it is. It was like 9 million or something like that.
Yeah, cool.
But no, I mean, it was a very successful spot for them. And I think it was their most successful, Microsoft's most watched ad of all time.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So we got another job out of it. And that one, I got to travel, which was sort of that was what I was interested in with that project. You know, it wasn't like incredibly creatively stimulating. It was fun. It was like a documentary piece. But yeah, the whole experience was good. So that kind of got me out. And the last year or 2 years that I was in Michigan, I was doing a lot of work abroad outside of the state and traveling for festivals, just getting new experiences mm-hmm. at premiering a film at South by Southwest. And then bringing it to Telluride, which is my favorite film festival in the country. Not like I've been to
right.
more than 20, but no, I haven't been to a place where I felt like film, the idea of a film festival, it's a celebration, right? So I hadn't been to a place that felt more like it was celebrating the craft of filmmaking as much as like a film festival tends to be just sort of a scene, you know, and there's panels and all this stuff going on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there it was just about the movies, and every film that I saw was just, I just was watching three or four a day, because they were all so good. And it mm-hmm. was the year that Argo premiered there.
Oh, wow.
That year, and all the features were premiering. It was their North American premiere, but mm-hmm. Argo was the secret premiere. So I was there for the very first public screening of that.
That's great.
It was exceptional. And then, you know, a number of those films with that premiere at Telluride go on and win Oscars. And, you know, I think it's a really influential place for keeping it as low key as it is compared to things that, you know, that get a little bit more attention, like Sundance or South by Southwest. So I really, really loved it there. Made me excited to be doing what I was doing. And then that kind of just led to LA, which I was not expecting. You know, if you'd asked me at the end of 2012, like, where are you going to move? I would have said, I don't know.
Right.
But I know one place that I'm not going to move.
Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Los Angeles. I was interested in moving to Copenhagen or London or even New York. But then when I went to Los Angeles, I felt like it was very different than what everyone had told me or the idea I had in my head.
It is. It's a lot different when you're here.
Yeah. And I thought it was really exciting. So, and then mainly I just wanted to be someplace warm. And I wasn't going to get much of a change of weather in the latter three.
Right.
So LA it was.
That's cool. And when did you officially move here? What year?
The beginning of 2013.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
So you were with Workhouse Creative. You have a couple agencies that you're now repped by, because you have like a United States agency, a Japanese agency, and then a European agency, right?
Yeah, yeah. So
I'll link all of this later because people will be able to see your website and everything. So.
Yeah, totally. So I joined with Little Minx in the U.S., which is branched off of RSA, Ridley Scott Associates. So it was kind of like a smaller production company being ran by Rhea Scott, his daughter-in-law. And then they branched off and became their own thing cool. a couple of years back. So I'm with them now in the U.S. And then I'm rep by Toboggan in Japan. Two Japanese producers who are incredibly good friends of mine. You know, mm-hmm. two of the best guys I've ever worked with. And we've done a lot together. And then also in the U.K. through a company that is Dan Dickinson's, who used to be with Partisan. And then helped founded Rocket, and then did his company Supergoober in London, which cool. is the one that reps me there. Yeah,
that's awesome. So in and amongst all of this, was there ever a point where, because you've lived a lot of places, so I don't really want to frame it around like being in LA, but like in and around all of this, you know, you're in film school, you kind of had to leave film school, but you obviously turned that into something that made you have a fire to kind of create else outside of that. Was there a point in time during any of this, you know, traveling and broadening where you just felt like fuck it, like it's too overwhelming, it's too much, it's too expensive to want to do or be this, you know what I mean? Has there been a time yet where you've sort of felt maybe like you wanted to throw in the towel and then just reined yourself in?
No.
How come?
I don't know.
Sure you do. What is it that hasn't ever been... I don't know. You've never had anything that's been big enough? Has there anything that's even been close to being big enough that's made you be like, this is too far out of the ordinary to sort of be where... I don't know. Like, there's a lot that you give up to pursue the lifestyle that
we normally
have,
the
right?
Things that people would describe as reasons not to be doing something are things that I like. So when you say... when it gets really difficult or some big problem happens or you feel unstable or you have no rhythm or you have no security or you don't know whatever is going to happen next, it's like that's the reality that I've lived in basically my entire life. So it doesn't feel abnormal. The reason that I started doing this was I couldn't really find anything harder to do. It's, I think... Paul Thomas Anderson described, you know, any movie, getting any movie to happen is sort of a miracle.
Yeah.
You know, just for a film to be shot is kind of a miracle. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. It's just, it never makes sense. It never seems possible every step of the way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why I'm really excited about virtual reality as well, because I think it's even more complicated. The depth that you have to think through for all these different layers and how they're going to work together, especially at this stage, is like completely overwhelming. I mean, to the point that I'm like, I shut down sometimes at night when I'm working on this because it just hurts your brain after a while because you're thinking theoretically and then hypothetically. Theoretically, if this were to happen, then hypothetically this would happen.
Right.
And you're trying to... you're creating these mass canvases in your mind, these sort of tapestries of possibility. And that can get overwhelming after a while. And just like, my brain isn't working anymore. But it's also, you know, I don't know what it is. I can't really help myself. It's just the moment that I know that there's something that there's like, yeah, that there's a higher thing to be reached or that there's something that demands a lot more work that's just more interesting to me. I wish, you know, I look at other artists who are just able to kind of be what I would consider prolific, and just turn out film after film. And I don't know how to do that because a lot of them, I feel like, oh, well, it's just kind of an expression and it's just this gust of just run out and do it and kind of make something and bam, it's done, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that that's really admirable. I like people who do work like that, and sometimes I want to be more like that, but I can't really help the fact that the process for me is kind of like enjoying the time that it takes to, you know, even this VR project that we're doing, it's the script itself for the project is, you know, 25, 26 pages, which in virtual reality is essentially a feature because it feels like you've been in there for an eternity for that long.
Right.
But the notes on the project, just the notes on visuals, on backstories, on commentary, on all this stuff. I mean, I have like 100 pages of notes mm-hmm. on those short pages of script. You know, and I like,
you're giving it a real reality.
I wouldn't want to do it any other way. You know, I think that that's exciting, kind of creating the depth of it. And you have to kind of, I think at the end of the day, just sort of be pleasing yourself and doing it the way that you want to do. And some work is more gratifying step by step, and you have a lot more feedback and affirmation. And this particular one is one that is less like that because of the nature of it. I'm excited to get through it and do it and make it, release it to people, and then move on to the next thing that I want to do, which I think will be a little bit of a more, you know, less of a painful process.
Do you know what your next thing is? What are you working on now?
So the project that I can speak of is an app that I've been developing with my partner for...
App is slang for application.
Yeah. It's a program. It is a computer program.
For your phone, your telephone, or your tablet.
Well, this build, it will be released for that too, shortly, but we just finished, the Mac version of it.
Cool.
So that has been, you know, when you create an application, you have to submit it to Apple and they have mm-hmm. to approve it, you know, make sure that it's not some crazy software malware, some
right.
nonsense. So that's submitted right now and being reviewed and all that.
Can you tell me what the app does, or do you have to wait until it's out?
Yeah, I can talk about it. So the app's called Flow State, and we've been working on it for a couple years.
And we is?
Blaine. My partner and best friend, Blaine.
Blaine?
Cron.
Right. No one knows who Blaine is.
I know.
People are going to think that you're working with David Blaine.
He likes to keep it that way.
People are going to think that you're working with David Blaine, and I don't want to give them the wrong impression. No, so your co-creator is Blaine...
Cron, yes. Cron. So, so Blaine and I have been working on this for a couple of years, and it's gone through different iterations, and I've been using it. This is an mm-hmm. application I kind of created this for myself to use, and I've been using it for 2 years, and mm-hmm. I use it in almost every single project that I do. So it's an integral part of my writing process.
Cool.
It's a writing app. It is so it's called Flow State. It's the most dangerous writing app, we say, and it functions on a couple of really core principles. One is that it's a completely immersive writing experience. You know, it's full screen only,
mm-hmm.
And it's a timed writing app. So basically, it's one conceit is that you choose the time that you're going to write for mm-hmm. in a completely blank environment. And you have to see it. Like, there's a lot of design involved. You know, I think we've spent a lot of time getting that. It does not look like any writing app you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And so you choose this time and for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, an hour, and you go into this mode that we call a flow session. And in this mode, you start typing. Now, when you start typing, the time starts going down. So you've committed to be in this space to write for however long you set, 15 minutes, say, mm-hmm. okay? So if you want to keep what you are writing right now, you have to complete that time. You have to finish that 15 minutes, and then it will save it into your document section of the application.
Will it not save it if you don't finish that time?
No. And more than that, the one rule of flow state and why it works the way it does is that if you are typing and say you've been typing 30 seconds a minute, if you stop typing, the letters that you've been typing start to fade. And if you type again, they come back. You know, mm-hmm. simple as that. But if you stop typing for 5 seconds, they fade away and you lose everything that you've done.
Oh, wow.
And there's no way to cheat it. There's no way to beat it. You have to play by the rules.
And so what's the purpose of that?
The purpose of that is the name, Flow State. So what it does is, you know, and I guess you could see it from a few different ways. I studied under the screenwriter, Stuart Stern, who mm-hmm. recently just passed away. But he wrote Rebel Without a Cause and Rachel and worked with Paul Newman for years. And he was an incredible mentor. And when I took his class, I was introduced to an approach to writing that I had never experienced before. I would consider myself sort of the classic male Western analytical writer, and mm-hmm. I think most people have experienced this, where you are writing something and then you are tweaking and then adjusting and then rereading what you just wrote,
right.
Like, and you find that you're making these, you're analyzing little minutiae,
mm-hmm.
Every half page, quarter page, or whatever, and I couldn't really help myself. It's just this way that I wrote, and that was fine for that time period. But in his course, I was introduced to this idea of timed writing.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd set the clock for like 10 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever, and we'd do these different sessions, and there'd kind of be a motive, like what you're writing about, like mm-hmm. a question, a prompt, so to speak. But in a classroom, and the one rule of the time was that your pen couldn't stop moving.
Mm-hmm.
And in a classroom setting, that works because it works on social pressure.
Right.
If this person to my right and this person to my left, they don't stop writing.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you write. It doesn't matter if you just write blah, 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 blah. Pen cannot stop moving.
Yeah.
But because everyone else is doing it, you just do it too.
Right.
And what happens is that when you do that, something clicks off. I truly believe that people can only... You cannot do two things at once.
Mm-hmm.
And you are either analyzing or you are expressing.
Mm-hmm.
You're creating or you're editing. You cannot do them both. And when you're bouncing between these two things, as we've taught our brains to bounce between Instagram and emails mm-hmm. and the movie I'm watching and the text I got. You know, we've taught our brain to bounce between them. And then when mm-hmm. you go to write, your brain wants to keep doing that activity. And I find that to be really disruptive.
Yeah.
But in this kind of a setting, because you're forced to just keep doing stuff, that analytical part, the editing part of your brain starts to quiet down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that the enemy of creativity is self-consciousness,
mm-hmm.
which is why I think that artists today have to ride this really interesting line between being culturally aware
mm-hmm.
and like aware of what's going on around them while never becoming like too politically correct or too self-conscious about what they're doing. Because if you're constantly like, oh, like I can't do that, it's like it's the enemy, you know.
Yeah.
You're editing yourself.
You're self-censoring.
Yes, yeah. You're self-censoring. So this process cuts that censor part of your brain off. Because there's not even room for you to be consciously, like, you're just whatever comes out. And
mm-hmm.
before you know it, these things start showing up. Things you didn't know you even had in you. Memories you didn't realize you had.
Yeah.
Opinions you didn't realize you had.
Yeah.
Connections you didn't realize you were making. Because it's like, it smooths out your subconscious into, like, a single laser beam.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen instantly. It doesn't happen in, like, 1 or 2 minutes. It takes a little while for
mm-hmm.
your, this wavelengths to kind of get a little bit more rhythmic.
Yeah.
So when I experienced that in his class, in Stuart's class, it just completely changed my life. But the problem is that I couldn't really have a classroom around me everywhere that I went, you know,
right.
for that sort of pressure.
Yeah.
And you can sit down, you can set a clock. But guess what? Someone does something or you just remembered, oh shit, I have to send that email. Suddenly,
yeah.
you just, it's really hard, you know, call
yeah.
it a lack of discipline. That's fine. You can call it whatever you want. But the fact is that I felt that myself and a lot of other people I knew had a difficult time focusing with the menagerie of distractions going on around
mm-hmm.
us. So this app was developed, you know, for the first time, this very old, I mean, time writing has been used by authors for like a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But this old process could be digitized and structured in a way with a strict set of rules
mm-hmm.
that it could be a compute. You're signing up for obstruction. Okay.
Right.
Like creativity doesn't happen when you have all the options in the world. It happens when you're working in a really obstructed environment. You know, a great documentary that was really inspiring to us early in the process of developing this app
mm-hmm.
is the only documentary that Lars von Trier has ever done.
Mm-hmm.
It's called The Five Obstructions.
Okay.
You gotta watch it.
Okay.
It is awesome. What it reveals about the artistic process.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he goes to this filmmaker that he admired very much as a film student.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw this short film of his and it was a big deal to him. So the documentary is about him getting that filmmaker, who's now much older, to come back and remake that short film
oh, wow.
5 times. And each time he has a different set of rules he has to follow. And these are rules ranging from it has to be shot in this country or in this language down to one version. I think he can't have a single shot that's longer than 23 frames. And he has to tell the same story.
Interesting.
You know? And what it reveals, I won't say what all the obstructions are, but what it reveals about the creative process, I thought was there's a lot to learn. So that's kind of our founding principle, is to kind of create rules. And I think that people can be their most creative because of that. I think that a lot of times we do our best work when we're under those kind of heavy deadlines. And I mean, everyone says that. That's not
mm-hmm.
new. That's not like
no.
magic realization. So what we thought was like, well, why can't you find, we have the power of computers, so why can't we impose those deadlines upon ourselves? We're already doing that. We're seeing people do that. Like the whole idea of Snapchat.
Yeah.
You know, I don't use Snapchat, but we were making Flow State before Snapchat came out.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment I heard about it, I was like, of course that's going to be popular. It makes sense.
Right. But
we already discovered those principles, that things are attractive when we don't get to do whatever we want,
yeah.
you know, but we know what the rules are. And it's fun to operate within them. It's like, you won't find a gamer who ever had a good time playing a game with all the cheat codes turned on. It's not fun anymore.
Speaking of gaming, that's a weird segue. You used to be like a professional gamer for a little bit, right? Like,
I wasn't a professional.
You were sort of like sponsored, right?
Yeah, I was sponsored and I toured and I did a lot of tournaments.
What did you play?
I played Halo. So
dude, when that's so crazy. Like, it's awesome to me because it's something, it's like another life that you had almost, because we did all that esports stuff, you know, and
yeah.
we were like so in it for a while. It's such an interesting part that you're like, well, I wasn't really like, I mean, I like went to tournaments and like I was sponsored and stuff, but like that's a whole different culture.
Yeah, it was a total universe. I mean, when I was playing Halo 2, I think, I mean, there were, I don't know how many exactly, but there were well over, you know, a million 2 million players online on Xbox Live, active players. And I was typically ranked in like the top 50 to top 100 free-for-all players in the world, you know. And I played mostly...
So it's like you and a bunch of kids from Japan.
No, actually, Japanese players weren't the best at that game. At other games. Japanese people tend to play Japanese video games, to be honest.
That's fair.
It's like League of Legends is a, you know, major video game all over the world.
Yeah.
But the one country they have no whole ground in is Japan. They just don't care. They've got more interesting things. But yeah, so I did that for years. And
did you make money?
A bit. I mean, not anything too much, but at that time, you know, even a little bit of money seemed like a lot.
How old were you?
I was 15 and 16 when I was really good at that. And then I was 16 or 17 when Halo 3 came out. And then that's when I got a sponsor. And then I started doing some tournaments, you know, throughout Midwest. And I've actually won a number of tournaments. I won my own copy of Halo 2 at a tournament, a Halo 1 tournament, a free-for-all tournament. So, like, they had, like, this big free-for-all match, and, yeah, it was dramatic.
Do you ever play anymore?
No.
Not even for fun?
No, not really. When I moved out when I was 17, and I kind of made a decision. I left my console with my brothers, and I gamed a lot. And I still love gaming, and there are some games that I enjoy. I really love the medium, but I gamed a lot, and I wrote a lot of music, played guitar, bass, and, like, all this stuff. I had a bunch of instruments, and I skateboarded a lot, and I made this decision around that time, shortly before I went to film school. So I guess this was after I moved out. I was about 18, that I was just going to give up those things, like, cold turkey, done. I'm not going
to
play guitar anymore. I'm not going
to
skate anymore.
On.
I'm not going to game anymore. I'm just going to... If the question was, what would happen if you took all this energy and you put it into one thing?
Mm-hmm.
That was the experiment. So that's what I did. And I've been doing it since.
I was going to say, a decade later.
I will be getting my first gaming console since then in 2016.
That's exciting. Do you fully anticipate, like, a cave status and just, like, going back in again and being like, dude, I just played Halo all the way through?
No, I don't think it'll be anything too crazy, but, you know, I'm, like I said, when I was at Oculus Connect, the things that are happening right now I think are way too exciting to ignore. So
that's why you're doing it.
Yeah.
What are you going to get?
I'll get the Oculus Touch system when it releases.
Cool.
That's what I'm most excited about. I mean, the Oculus and the way that it operates with a controller is, like, more for gaming, but it's the Oculus Touch and the capabilities of that that I think are the dawn of something quite wonderful.
Cool. So you've got the Flow State app. You've got your super secret projects that you can't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got sort of doing commercials and stuff. Like, that's still sort of, you know, just all you're always sort of booked on things and got, you were like back and forth from Japan recently. Like, what else are you gonna just be in town for a while or
I'm staying here. A lot of the work that I'm doing here is here in town, you know. There are a number of things running and a lot of commitments I have to the other people involved in them. So
does it feel good to be here for a while?
Yeah, I mean, it does. What we're doing right now involves a lot of acting and a lot of,
auditioning
and rehearsals and stuff like that. So that's been really, really rewarding. I mean, I don't think that I never really feel more satisfied than when I'm just in a rehearsal with actors.
Yeah.
It's like my favorite time to just play around. I'm going to stick around for a little bit, keep working in town, keep doing
this
stuff.
How can people get in touch with you if they want to do that?
They can't.
You're like, I don't have a phone. Caleb doesn't have a phone, you guys. You still don't have a phone, right?
I don't have an operating phone. I do have
Bill Murray, but like 25 years old. Do you know how he books his roles, right?
He has a hotline. Yeah.
Apparently
right,
that's legitimately real. Like, I read an article about a filmmaker who got him in a...
I read that too.
Yeah, it was so great. He would just call.
And you had to leave messages.
Yeah.
But even that, he knew someone who finally got a hold of him to kind of vouch. I don't really go out of my way to be available. That's its own conversation, to be honest. Like, whether the sort of
That's why I asked.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that there's a little bit too much social rewards right now. I think for artists to have really quiet space and think outside of the main thrust of things. You know, there's this, I unearthed this Steve Jobs talk recently. I didn't unearth it. Actually, a friend of mine sent it to me. They had just kind of shown up online, and I've seen almost all of them. So this is, oh, neat. There's something new. And it was a talk that he gave in 82, I think. So he would have been 27? Yeah, 27. And he talked about experience, and he was encouraging these people, this Academy of Achievement, that when people were asking about him and the work that he'd done and how he was able to do what he's done so early and so young, it's that, you know, that you're really, at the end of the day, you're just being you with the problems that you're being given. So you can sit there and try to deal with the problems differently, but you can't get outside of who you are. What you do have control over is to go out and have experiences that are outside of just the normal way of things, you know? Like, if you're 18 or 19, like, go to a third world country and figure out what people don't do there and then go do that. Or go, you know, go to, like, a gaming tournaments in Canada. Yeah. Or go do something else. But, I mean, I think if you're continuing to build your sense of the world and your life based on what you're seeing on the internet and what you're seeing on Facebook and Instagram and these sort of sources around you, you're getting the exact same life experience that everyone else is getting.
Right.
There's absolutely nothing in your experience that's going to be different than that. And I think that you have an opportunity to just go looking for what's weird. Mm-hmm. If you want to make things that are different, if that's something that speaks to you, I think you're going to, you know, have a chance to develop yourself into a really interesting tree. And that's within your own control. That is something you can control.
That's a good perspective, I think. So, what would you say to people who are in film school right now? Just really broad. Like, I'm interested in what, given your perspective on it, I feel like I love talking to filmmakers about what their post-school perspective is. So, what would you say to people who are in film school right now, listening to this? Maybe they're fans of yours. You know, maybe they've seen some of your shit at, like, Nifty or, you know, what would you say to them in terms of...
I couldn't say anything to them. I mean, I've had
you
some...
You have to say something.
I've met kids at festivals, and I've had, you know, I've had these, like, phone calls, and I've counseled kids, you know, a number of people who've reached out to me and asked advice on that, who were in school and felt a bit disenfranchised and... and the advice that I give is different every single time. So, you know, it changes. I know what I did, but I also don't know what it's like to be in your school or somewhere else. So I think that you kind of have to just trust your feeling. And ultimately all it comes down to is, like, you have to be making stuff on your own.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be finding a way. Now, if that takes external forces to help you do that, and schools helping you keep making things, and that making is making you feel fulfilled and satisfied, then that's all right. Okay, fine. Just as long as you're staying busy and doing things that you really enjoy. But you can't, if you find yourself making excuses, well, I couldn't really do this because, you know, the project was supposed to be this. I think that that's where it gets into a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, every single commercial that I've been given, American commercial I've been given up until this point, started as something that was supposed to be not good. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be a throwaway.
Yeah.
The first major commercial I did, the Surface piece, all that was supposed to be was a demonstration of that object.
Yeah.
It was a video just to show what it looked like. It wasn't an ad. It wasn't a commercial. It was just a video that they could show when they announced it. Here's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And we pushed that so far to the point that we literally bought a vial of liquid mercury on the black market to get on set to use for some shots that we were doing.
Oh, wow.
And this whole fiasco broke out on set, and I actually I didn't tell anyone on set. I actually really haven't, I don't know if I've, how many people I've ever told this to, but when we were shooting, people were so paranoid, I couldn't say this to anyone. But I went over to make an adjustment when we were doing this thing where this mercury was coming down and splashing. Mm-hmm. And I was holding, I get kind of hands-on yeah. with production design. Like, I'll go and I move stuff, and I move stuff around. I check the framing. Yeah. And so I saw something that I wanted to bounce some light in a little bit. And we're on a pretty big set. A lot of people there. And they do this pour in super slow motion where this mercury, liquid mercury is coming down over the device. Mm-hmm. And it, what's interesting about mercury is when it splashes, it's heavy.
Yeah.
So it's not like water. It just, it like goes like pop.
Yeah.
It's like it just explodes and then it just sticks to everything that it hits.
Yeah.
So a droplet of mercury, significant droplet of mercury, when I was there holding this thing, hit and it went right outside the guard.
Yeah.
The splash guard for the camera, and it went straight into my eye. Like, on my eye.
Your eyeball?
My eyeball.
Oh, my God.
And I remember standing there just thinking, don't blink. Don't blink. And I could feel it on my eye. And I got up really... And I'm telling you, the mood on set, there was our first assistant camera guy was freaking out. And he's, yeah. like, on his phone looking up, like... if people should be wearing masks around this, and, you know, and he's kind of paranoid. At some point, he was just asked to kind of leave and go outside.
Yeah.
pardon me. So I got up really calmly, and I knew if I made any to-do or fuss, the whole thing was just going to break down.
Yeah.
And we were, like, on a really tight schedule to get this. So I just said, okay, let's reset the shot. Let's collect as much as we can. And I kind of kept my head down. And I walked past everyone while they were resetting, and I went into the bathroom without blinking, and I got a piece of paper towel, and I absorbed it off of my eye, and then, like, dried my eye, basically, to get all the...
Oh, my God,
And never told anyone. No one knew.
Until this moment, right now.
I've told a couple people. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like...
Which
eye? Was that necessary?
In case you go blind in the future.
I don't even remember. I think it was probably my left. But I mean, was any of that necessary? Was I being paid anything extra to do any of that?
No.
No.
Yeah.
No. It was for a fucking Microsoft commercial. I think it just goes back to what we were talking about earlier about sort of what you do with what's been given to you. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe strongly that no one ever gets like no one's ever going to do you a favor.
Right.
No one's ever going to give you your dream project. No one ever gets their dream project. It starts as something different. And you can't romanticize the past or what you think you're seeing, because you never know all the details of how a film really got off the ground, or how someone made that album, or how someone created that, you know, piece of art. It just starts with right now what you have. And, you know, I guess all I'm saying was just that if I've learned anything in terms of people being in film school or whatever, is that I haven't been given like a lot of things where people had really high expectations, but I approached them very ambitiously and pushed them as far as I felt I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, there are almost no projects that I look back on and am unhappy with.
That's great.
There, you know, very, very, very few, because I know that I did everything I could on that. I really, really did. And I might learn from it looking back and say, I don't really like that anymore, this thing, or completely this is like garbage or whatever, but it doesn't come from a place of like feeling like it could have been better if I had that feeling to have them change that sound thing. And it's always bothered me. I always thought that sound in the room sounded weird, and every time I watch it I feel like it sounds weird, you know, like, mm-hmm. if that happens, like, we take care of it. We
right.
find a way until everything feels okay.
Right.
So it's the same thing in film school, right? If you're, you got to take it as far as you want to take it. And if you're not doing that, or you feel like it's not a place that's really allowing you to do that, then don't do it. You know, mm-hmm. There's nothing in this world that you're going to get experience from as much as just making stuff with your friends,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, listening to commentaries, watching movies. And just to keep shooting stuff. Everyone says that. All directors say, just go out and direct stuff. Just go out and shoot stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't be repeated enough.
Yeah.
You know, you can find all the excuses in the world not to do it, but it's not going to be profound at the beginning. If you're waiting to get some profound idea to go do, that's not going to happen. It's going to show up along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to go to the first one to realize, oh, that doesn't really work, but now you're moving.
Right.
And then you'll find the next thing and the next thing. And by the time you get to the end, it won't even resemble what actually got you excited about it at the beginning. And that's how it should work.
And do you have anything in any festivals, or are you traveling anytime soon? You're here for a while.
No, I don't have anything. I've put the kibosh on all forms of traveling and whatever. We're just keeping the head down, working. Lots of the old fashioned sort of work going on.
Nose to the grindstone.
Yeah. It's not flashy. It's not fashionable sort of work right now. But yeah, we did these projects. I did a bit of traveling for the last two commercials that I did, and that was nice. And now we're just staying still.
Nice.
Well, thanks for having me. And yeah, if someone does really have a question, there is an email buried on my website.
Yeah, which is calebslane.com, right?
yo@calebslane.com.
That's the email. yo@calebslane.com.
You got it. You know what your sign off should be?
What?
You should have the computer read erotic short stories. Short stories.
50 Shades of Grey.
No, I mean like good old like hard erotica.
It doesn't seem like that would be that strange. I can kind of imagine, because now in my head it's just like the
hearing the computer voice.
Yeah, like from 2001.
Yeah.
That's what I'm imagining is reading it right now. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think I'll stick with at least the broad stroke of the sign off that I have right now. In lieu of old time erotica written and read in radio show fashion, I'll just leave it with have a great week, guys. Thanks for listening, and hope you get to do something that feeds your soul.